Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Dr. John Stamey live in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and we have got what we think is the best paranormal show in the universe and on the internet and everywhere else. So here is ScaryCast for tonight. We've got a couple of great guests, and so we're going to get started with them here right quickly. First of all, we've got from Roswell, New Mexico, paranormal author John LeMay. Good evening, John. How are you doing?
Hey, John and Matt. I'm glad to be here.
Well, good. Well, we're glad to have you here. And in no particular order, we have the man from Parts Unknown, probably Mark Johnston. How are you doing tonight, Mark?
Hey, guys. Excited for tonight's show. John LeMay, and is Matt Delph with us as well tonight?
Well, I'm getting ready to introduce him, Matt, the one
Sweet.
And only
That's...
From somewhere, from Parts Unknown in Virginia, maybe Ewing, Virginia. Matt, do you think that's Parts Unknown? It's Matt Delph. How you doing?
I'm doing great, and I would definitely say it's Parts Unknown. Definitely.
I think it is, to borrow a great wrestling phrase, because, you know, on Sunday night, I do pro wrestling interviews starring the Amazing Velvet and me and Sinister and Papa Stroh and Steve Logan, and we have just a great time. But whenever we use Parts Unknown, that is a very important phrase in wrestling, because that's where, so that everybody knows, that's where all of the masked wrestlers come from.
Just before we start the show, I just want to mention, I've been reading John's book, Cowboys and Monsters, Vampires, Mummies, and Werewolves of the Wild West. And I've just been going through, and there's a whole bunch of stories. I've just been kind of selecting them, ones on what I was interested in reading, and I highly suggest for anybody listening, it's a great book. Pick that one up.
Listen, I want to tell everybody something. I think John LeMay is an incredible author. And I'm not saying that because he's one of my very good friends. I think he's a good writer, and I enjoy his stuff and all that. So, again, John, I'll say that. And now I wanted to say something. Even though the queen of ScaryCast is not here with us, from Parts Unknown, we have the queen of ScaryCast. Don't we, Robin?
Hi, guys.
Hi, Robin.
I was dealing with the apples, and I looked up and went, oh, no. Hi,
we're
everybody.
We're so glad you're here.
Hello.
Hey, Robin.
And I wanted to start the show off with a thank you to two people. This past Friday night, I was a guest on Unexplained, starring William Shatner. And I want to say thank you so much to William Shatner and his team for having me in Hollywood to film that. And they did such a great job. And, you know, it's on history.com. If you've got a landline, subscription, you can see it. And it was wonderful. But also, I wanted to thank a very close friend of mine, and that is none other than the queen of ScaryCast, Robin McCrae. Robin, are you ready for some kind words?
I'll take the kind words any day of the week.
Very good. I wanted to say that since I have met Robin, I met Robin 4 years ago. She's like a sister to me, absolutely. She checks on me all the time. And number one, I really appreciate that. And number two, Robin has taught me so much about the cryptid world, especially the Bigfoot world, and kind of by osmosis, I've been able to apply that to the lizard man world, and, you know, now the book's getting ready to come out, and John LeMay, thank you for helping on that. But I wanted to say thanks to Robin McCrae for being such a good educator to me. I wouldn't have been on Unexplained, starring William Shatner, had it not been for the kindness of Robin McCrae, who has taught me a lot, And I wanted, I wanted to say thank you so much for all that you have done, and just couldn't do it without you. And that's why we have the Queen of Scary Cast on here whenever she can be here. She's a pretty darn cool gal. She is, and I'll tell you what, she's got a fantastic husband who is so nice, Pat McCray. Can't get onto this show without thanking Pat McCray for all his friendship and all the good things that he does and has helped. They've taught me a lot, and I want to say thanks to them. They are great people.
Oh, well, we both thank you. You have been such a good friend, family to us, and you are just such a blessing.
Well, thanks. Oh, back to the business at hand.
I want to say one thing about the show you were on. If anybody can't get it or is only doing streaming, if you go on Google Play TV for $2, you can rent it to see this episode. And it is fabulous. I would recommend it to anybody.
What's the whole name of it called? The name of the episode even, John?
It's called the Missing Links.
No, it's William Shatner, The Unexplained episode, season 4, episode 10, and it's called The Missing Link.
The Missing Link. Okay, that's what I'm looking for. Cool.
All right.
Awesome.
So, and I'm going to try.
I'm going to check that out after.
I'm going to try. Now, Mark and John and Matt and everybody, I'm going to try to put together a clip of that which has my stuff in it. They said that was mine. They don't care. They want the publicity. They want people to see this show. Because this is, I'm going to tell you what, I was so impressed with the research that they. Good thing about it. So, to our guests.
Is John cutting out there?
I think we're having some technical difficulties. Are you there, John?
Yeah, I will, as I frequently have to do. I'll stay outside. We're going to take care of this internet next week. But anyway, I hope everyone can hear me now. And first of all, John May, tell us about your latest book that's out and where we can find it.
Oh, you're talking about the one I just sent you?
Yes, that and I think any other current books you've got.
Yes, I just did. I put out my first novel, which I've been working on since I was 19, so almost half my life now. It's, you know, sometimes we talk about Billy the Kid's spooky gravesite where he always gets his tombstone stolen, so it's the whole novel's kind of dedicated to the real-life mystery and history of Billy the Kid's stolen tombstone, but it's called The Noted Desperado, Pancho Dumez. And if you can't remember the title, you know, just search my name on Amazon and poke around my different books and you'll find it. But that's my newest one. And
wasn't there something in this book, The Cowboy and Monsters, that was Billy the Kid as well in that one?
Yeah, I did in Cowboys and Monsters, I tried to do some chapters on Old West mummies. And Billy the Kid didn't really have an Old West mummy per se, but supposedly they cut his trigger finger off and mummified it and pickled it, and it toured around the country in traveling fairs. So, I mean, as opposed to his whole mummy, it was just his trigger finger. But it's still pretty cool and interesting. I don't know if I believe it, but it's just part of the folklore.
Yeah. I thought I saw something when I was looking through the chapters.
Well, that's great. And Matt Delf. Now, Matt, tell us about your research group that people can join if they so choose, and this great research group you've got. Tell us about it.
Okay. Well, I've worked with several different groups, but my main group is the Mountain Empire Crypt Research Organization. You can find it on Facebook under MECRO or Mountain Empire Crypt Research Organization. If you can't find it, just find me on Facebook, Matthew Delp. And I will add you to the group. And I work with several other groups, military classified groups. I help out with the BFRO, got some good friends in those. So, yeah, I'm all over the place.
Well, that's great. Well, now tonight, the first part of our show, and this is very important, we're here to talk about the land between the lakes. Now, John LeMay has written fairly extensively about the land between the lakes, and that is the southern part of Kentucky. Matt Delf has been there, and Matt Delf has been there doing research with a family that's there, and he's going to bring, hopefully, some of those members of his family onto the show in upcoming weeks. But so, John, I want you to start out by telling us about the land of the land between lakes, and then, Matt, I want you to talk about being there. So, John LeMay, you are at bat.
Yeah, so the land between lakes I wrote about in the book that Mark brought up, Cowboys and Monsters, which, you know, is about werewolves and stuff like that in the Wild West. And, you know, I've already forgotten a lot of the details of that chapter, but the gist of it is they have a lot of werewolf sightings in that area, and they have different explanations for them. You know, one of the backstories, I think, was that it was an immigrant family from Europe, supposedly, that they were just kind of weird, and nobody really understood them because they didn't speak English very well. And, you know, somehow a rumor started that they could turn into wolves at night, and one day they went to their homestead and they had all mysteriously vanished. That's one iteration. Then the other iteration, I think, is that there was a Native American chief of some kind who I think he got shot or he got died or something, and he put a curse on everybody and he could turn into a wolf. I mean, whatever I have in my book is correct. It's just the problem is I've already forgotten all about that. So maybe Matt better correct me on that, on the werewolves of the land between lakes, because that's just kind of what I remember about it.
Well, now that's interesting, yeah. that you call them werewolves, because some people call them other things. Now, Robin, I know that you are aware of the land between the lakes, and do you know off the top of your head the horrifying story of that family that was, say cannibalized?
Word by word, but, you know, the thing of it is these things, and I'm going to say this, and I'm going to be the bad guy in the group. I've talked to these things. Pat's talked to these things. They go to the LBL to get away from us. They hate humans. They want nothing to do with humans. To begin with, the dogmen are more dangerous than the werewolves, okay? The werewolves don't have the tail. The dogmen do. But they literally go there to avoid us. And it's really sad because we have people that go up there to camp that have no idea that these cryptids exist. And, you know, there's families that have been killed up there. They've had several different accounts of finding bodies hung up in trees from the dogmen. You know, to my knowledge, I've never been there. I have no intention of going there, not out of fear, but out of respect for the fact that these things don't want us there. But the thing is, I don't know, and Matt would know this part more than I would, whether or not it's posted that people shouldn't be there. Is it made clear that it's not a safe area? These things exist.
No.
The bad ones exist. And they've got to have a place to go. And for whatever reason, that's where they've settled. And everything that's rogue, everything that, whether it's a Bigfoot, a dog man, a goat man or whatever, all the rogues head to that area. I personally believe there's a vortex there that's spinning the wrong way, because when it spins the wrong way, it pulls out all the evil stuff out of the center of the earth and shoots it up, and it creates negative energy, and these things are drawn to that. But they've got to go somewhere, okay? Good, bad, or indifferent, they've got to go somewhere. And this is where they go to get away from people. But yet we keep going after them. I can't understand that. I just don't get it. But it's very sad because you have a lot of people that have no knowledge that cryptids even exist, and they walk right into this zone. You know, and if
so
they're not
the,
around it.
What's the story about this place? What's the story about this place? Because I'm trying to follow, and it's like, so what's the background on the land of the lakes? What is supposed to happen there?
People get killed there all the time.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Nat.
Actually, what? Okay. Back in the from way back when, way back settlers, stuff like that, as John was talking earlier, with they talked about it could be a shaman, that, you know, shapeshifter, and so forth. But they've had all these reports of this canine-like type creature, whether it be a werewolf or dog man. But reportedly, it would attack people, kill livestock, stuff like that throughout the area. Well, in 1963, Kennedy had, it used to be called Land Between the Rivers. Well, in 1963, Kennedy forced, made it into a park and forced people from their homes in that area. A lot of people were mad because, I mean, they were forced from their homes, and they made a couple dams. So it's in between Lake Barkley and Lake Kentucky, and it goes into Tennessee and Kentucky. It's both states. And so as early, I remember the one of the first things in 1973, a group of students from Murray State University were in there. They were camping. They heard something going around their campsite. So they had, you know, they didn't think much about it. They thought it could have been anything. Well, they kind of got spooked, and they were getting out of there, and they were in this Volkswagen van, and they were leaving, and they seen this canine-type creature that was chasing them. And at one point, they had to slow down, make a turn, and the thing grabbed the back of their Volkswagen, and it was, you know, they were spinning tires, and this thing was strong enough to hold it there until they actually floored it really hard and got away from it. And it had, you know, of course, scratches down the side of it. And then in the early 80s, I think it was 82, if I remember correctly, there was family that was supposedly slaughtered there at a campsite, and they had found the dad was mauled, the boy was mauled, the wife was mauled. They had, that thing had even tore into their camper and got them, and then the cops had found, I guess, supposedly clothes of a another sibling that was female, and they found a little girl on top of a tree been eaten on. Whether that's true or not, you know, we don't know. Well, we just have to go by speculation.
So that sounds then, like a potential bear encounter. Like, what would differentiate a bear encounter from this one? Was there any signs?
There are
that?
No bears. There are no bears located there in Land Between the Lakes. It's not a bear area. Supposedly they had DNA from it, and it come back as a canine type, but it was an unknown canine. I've had heard another report that was canine, human, and a primate, which kind of sounds crazy, all three of them. But through the years, there's been other accounts, and the area that I had went to was where a bow hunter had went, and he was hunting. He set up a tent, and he was camping, and supposedly something had tore through his tent, and it had bit. He had put his bow up, and it had snapped through his bow and bit through his bow, and they found his body like a mile away. And the area that I went to was actually where I camped at that night, was at the location of where the bow hunter's body was supposedly found. But as like she said, she was wanting to know, okay, they only allow this. This is what really caught me, you know, brought my attention. I've always been attracted to that area. I can feel this energy like it's bringing me to that area. And, of course, if it's something risky, then, you know, I'm right there, nose first in it. And it was kind of odd because, okay, they do drawing. They allow some hunting in some of the area. But when I went there, you had to get a permit to camp there. But they didn't. Most parts you have to sign in. You have to let them know where you're at, document it. Not there. We didn't have to do none of that, which they thought was kind of odd, some of them. And I went there with the Henderson family from Cryptid Studies, great group, great group, great family, and a friend Jay Bradley, who is a professional fishing guide out of Pigeon Forge in Gatlinburg area over there in the Smokies. And we had went to the site, But what was odd, what I noticed was that area, there's lots of deer there, but at nighttime they was all on the road. They had left the forest out to the road. Now, it could be because they maybe it was in November, so I don't think it had snowed yet. It was cold that night that we were there, but I don't think it had snowed yet. So there shouldn't have been any salt on the roads, but they were all out at the road at nighttime. And we had some interesting stuff happen that night.
Now, Matt, I want to jump in and ask you a question. You were talking about this gentleman, and isn't it true that you and I had a little discussion earlier, you know, a couple weeks ago, that this was part of a family that did research up there between the lakes?
Yes, the Henderson family, they live pretty close, and they know a lot of history. They know where all the supposable sites are at, you know, different things, account. They get to hear the locals. They talk to them a lot. Very well knowledgeable of the whole area. And
well,
they were actually...
Well, let me ask you this. I'm sorry for interrupting you, but I'm very excited. Do you think there's a chance we could get a member of this family on the show?
Yeah, I'm going to talk to Elijah, and he's the oldest son, and I'll see if he can come on. I'm sure he'll make some time. He's a great guy. The whole family was great.
Well, that's great, because you know what's interesting about Scarycast is that we make such great relationships between people, and that's where we get our guests. And I think that's the right way to get our guests, because we have some interesting people. We got Nick Barnett on next week or the week after. We've got just such great guests. So anyway, I'm going to turn it back over to you to finish, Matt, and then I want John LeMay's comments, and then I want, because we've got our two commentators, we've got Robin and we've got Mark, so we'll have them on to ask questions. But anyway, please continue, Matt.
Okay, and as like Robin said, these things go there to get away from people. I've noticed also that week that we were there, that weekend, they were hunting wild boar from helicopters with snipers. To me,
cool.
That's a little costly. I wouldn't see why they just wouldn't put up a hog trap and try and catch a bunch at once and then relocate them. But I thought it was kind of odd that they were... I mean, I've heard of it done, of course, but I just thought it was odd to use that a sniper. You know, they're paying. That's a lot of money come out of
for
a helicopter.
They were doing it, but they were probably going after the dogmen up there. I don't think for two seconds they were looking for hogs.
Exactly.
Was it at nighttime?
Course,
was it night
public.
Or daytime?
Yes, at nighttime.
At nighttime
with
helicopter? So night for like a thermal or something? That doesn't seem right.
Exactly. But they were in there doing that week, and they had also, what was kind of cool was, okay, the Henderson family had been ran out of there before, and they've got audio and stuff. And what we always do, we always set up recorders and audio. Now, a coyote or a wolf, when they make a howl, it's a two-tone howl. So as the night went on, we heard one howl. And I recognized it, and I told him it was a coyote. And I said, it sounds like it's looking for the pack. Well, the pack responded. So, but then they were kind of going back and forth. Well, then a deeper, longer howl had came, and it was a three-toned howl. And they've got the recording on it as well. But you can hear it, and it's going farther down the creek. So it was going away from us. So we could only get a couple recordings of the sound, but it was going farther down the creek from us that night. But that area just had a whole strange, the energy was totally different. It was a spooky, but you could tell it was high energy. So like she was talking about, you know, something, a spiral, you know, something, portal, whatever you want to call it, but the energy was high there that night. And
is this a very remote area?
Yes, yes. We were way off the main road. We were way back in there. And there wasn't, you know, nobody around, nothing like that. And it got down to like 19 degrees at night that we were there. So it's pretty cold. And
Matt, I'm going to stop you there. If it's 19 degrees, I'm not going there, okay?
Yeah, it was cold.
I don't do that.
John LeMay,
do you do 19 degrees? I don't think you do.
I was about to say, I think John can handle the dog, man. He just can't handle the cold. That's what I take away from it.
What you guys need is a Canadian. So. You need somebody who's used to the cold
Mark
to go in there. I don't care. Exactly.
In other words, we need someone from Niagara Falls, Canada. Correct, Mark?
Yeah, well, I was just listening to the story, and it's really interesting, the fact, and I was just going to ask Matt, like, there's no possibility that there was any kind of Bigfoot relation to, A, the original story, or B, potentially what you experienced at that time?
Not that time. The howl was definitely not a Bigfoot. It was a canine type, but it did not sound like a wolf or a coyote. Like I said, it had a three-tone howl, and it was deeper and longer. And it was going away, so they caught some of the audio of it. And you can hear it's a little bit different. Now, there has been Bigfoot reports in that area as well. So, you know, but most of the activity that everybody talks about, that it's a canine type animal. It's like this one guy that worked there for the DNR, he supposedly, when he was on his deathbed, he had cancer, and he had to tell a story about, because it's 320 miles of shoreline in that area, 200 miles of hiking area. I think it's like 1,170 acres, the whole area is. Well, all the reports that I've heard have been mostly dog men, but I have heard reports of Bigfoot activity. Now, whether them two probably clash, you know, I'd say one stays on one end, the other one stays on another end. You know, I'm not sure. But that guy, that Department of Natural Resources, he claimed that he had seen from the shoreline, he was out in a boat, and he had seen there were a couple campers, and they had their tent set up, and he noticed a canine-type creature close to their tent, but they didn't see it, and they come out. So he was trying to signal to them to, hey, you know, there's something, you need to watch it right there. And they thought he was trying to wave, so they started waving. And this, he said, canine come out of nowhere and killed them both. Of course, it wasn't in the papers. It wasn't anything like that. But that whole area is really spooky because they talk about witches in the area, seeing orbs above the old graveyards.
Is there any type of geological abnormalities there, such as, like, I don't know, like a huge crystal deposit or anything that's weird that would, or like on a ley line or something like that, that would suggest that?
I'm not sure. It didn't.
Because it's between two lakes.
It's
like a land between two lakes, am I correct? So even that in itself is kind of some geological kind of thing, situation.
Exactly.
Is there something with the lakes? Often like where I've lived before, Ogopogo monster was in the lake right beside where I lived. So lakes have always had this type of legend association to it.
Well, these were man-made lakes. So in 63, it was land between two rivers, but why Kennedy forced these people out of their homes is another question. So they built dams up, and, you know, it's like they wanted people out of there, which they still allow some people because they still have, you know, for tourists and stuff. And on the main drive going through there, you can see, like, bison, and I believe they have some elk that they have there, but they're, of course, they're fenced in. But I couldn't believe how much the deer activity that night was out on the road. I mean, if you were driving down the road there at nighttime, every 5 to 10 minutes you had to watch out because there's a herd of deer out there in the road. It's like they were getting out of the forest for some reason.
That's pretty common from where I live, where there was tons of deer, though. But, like, I know it's not always the case, but where I live, they would always just walk along the road, though. So it's like That's just where they chilled and ate grass beside it or something? But were they, or were they actually on the road itself?
They were actually on the road itself. I mean, you had to be careful. Uh-huh. I mean, a lot of times, you know, during, especially during the rut and stuff, which, you know, I think it was in November, so the rut may have been in. They roam a lot. But, I mean, you'll see them here and there. But, I mean, these were like, it was unreal. I mean, I've hunted my whole life and stuff, but I'd never seen that many deer out on the highway like I did that night.
Wow, that's amazing. All right, Robin, do you have any comments or questions for Matt or John LeMay?
No, not really. I mean, you know, like I said, I've talked to the ones that are there. Pat's talked to them. We've done it multiple times. Years ago, I did a little bit of remote viewing, and well, I've done a lot of remote viewing over there, but a lot of remote work over there, and at that time, the Bigfoot and the Dogman were all running together. Like I said, that is where all the rejects go. That is where all the bad stuff goes. I personally think that there's a vortex there, which it's spinning the wrong way, which creates the bad energy, and that stuff is drawn to it. But no matter what the reasoning is, that is what they consider their turf now. That is their home ground. That is home base. They have to go somewhere. You know, and if you watch anything in the cryptid world, things will go way up in the mountains purposely to get away from us. What do? We chase them up the mountains. And then when they act like a bunch of lunatics and come after us because we've now chased them and they can't, there's nowhere else for them to go. They keep going up and up and up, and we're still going after them. Then we have the government comes in.
Excuse me, Robin. Do you think you're talking about Dyatlov Pass?
No. But, I mean, no, that's a different situation. I'm just talking about in general. And then they behave badly because we've chased them up these mountains. They attack us, and then they're the ones that have to suffer the consequences and get killed. And it's pretty much the same thing over there. You know, you've got people that go to camp there because they don't know any better. You know, the area, they're not giving a clear picture. I think Matt, we hit the nail on the head when he said that they were, you know, up in this helicopter supposedly hunting for hogs at night. Number one, you can't see a bloody thing at night. So why in the world would you be hunting hogs at night? Yeah, it doesn't even make sense.
I have an answer to that. If they're using thermals, they'll be glowing like a Christmas tree light in the middle of a forest in nighttime with thermals. But I wouldn't suggest that with a helicopter hunting at night. We're just hunting at night in general because you'd get a false reading or something. You know, that could be an accident.
Yeah.
Although I imagine if they it'd be a lot easier to spot a herd of them. That's my only theory about why they do it at night. But to be honest, I wouldn't recommend that.
See, that makes no sense because everybody that hunts, everybody that has a weapon knows you don't start shooting blindly into the woods at night. You don't start shooting blindly anywhere at night. You know, why put
like,
at night
thermals
when you can see them during the day?
Right.
I mean, it makes no sense.
But most of your hog hunters hunt at night. Most of your hog hunting happens at night because they're more active at nighttime.
See,
so
here,
a lot of your hog hunting.
In the South, they go at them during the day. Like in Michigan, we didn't have a lot of hog hunting. We don't have a lot of feral hogs like they do in the South. We have some, absolutely. But here during the day, you catch them out and they're out hunting them. But they normally use the pens.
Exactly.
You know,
I have a night optic for my guns. I can throw on like a Picatinny rail, and I see that one often used for hog hunting because, like I said, like I think they just stand out in the forest more. And they're hard to spot sometimes, especially by helicopter. Imagine it's a lot easier at night to see them by thermal, like we used to hunt Taliban in the middle of the desert with. It's pretty much the same thing, but nonetheless, I wouldn't recommend hunting at night in general. But in the States, you guys have different rules, regulations than we do.
But the thing is the cost of that, you know, when they could just put up a hog pen. They could just put up a hog pen. And as soon as they go in, put some feed in there like they do in the Smokies. That's how they do in the Smoky Mountains. They just
that's
set up traps.
That's what they do everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. Why don't they do that? Especially if they're all on that island anyhow. It ain't like they're gonna have a whole lot of area to run, you know.
And the other thing too is, you know, anytime there is any type of an attack, whether it's from a Bigfoot, a dogman, a kangaroo, it always comes down to the same thing. It was a wild dog attack. It was a wild dog attack, or they're doing something else when this happened. And as far as I, you know, from what Matt has described to me, my intuition tells me they weren't looking for hogs. They were looking for the dogman because they're trying to thin them out because they don't want to lose any revenue from people going up there camping, and people are at risk. They 100% are at risk.
Is there any coyotes in that area?
Yes, lots of coyotes.
Yeah, they're not normally that aggressive towards humans, although they can be, right? And especially if there's a human accident, like, and then you come across it a day or two later, animals will get at it before we, even birds will, and pick apart a carcass, right?
Exactly.
So potentially, when you look at things that could be torn apart, per se, right, and that's the evidence you're looking at, like, as far as forensics goes, you know, it could be a number of things. Although, what I like to look at it in, like, another historical context is, like, the werewolf in, like, England. And there's been werewolf stories other parts of the world that correspond. And it's, like, to me, does that lead to evidence as far as things go? Although, I haven't seen any video evidence myself. I haven't seen any pictures. So that's, like, modern-day evidence I would look for, which I haven't really seen. Maybe you guys could throw my direction in something along those lines. But
They had large fall marks. A kid on a dirt bike one time was riding through there, and he said it was canine, but they have these hands that are, and they got these long claws on them. And these claw marks and the bite marks supposedly on the people is a lot larger than coyote. It's larger than, like, a mountain lion or anything like that. Because my first thought, whenever they found it up in a tree, supposedly, we don't know if it's true or not, just, you know, allegedly, they had found the body up in a tree, I thought, well, that's a mountain lion probably. But these claw marks, in which if you're investigating a kill, you can measure in how far the bite went. And this exceeded a coyote's snout. It was, I guess, large, and these canine teeth were large, the bite marks on these things. And they left claw marks on, like, the camper, supposedly, you know, the Volkswagen little van that the students had from Murray State.
Bus.
Yeah. So, you know, they're leaving these claw marks, too, and they're getting that type of evidence. But it's all, you know, of course, it's not ever going to be documented. Just like whenever we went in there, I was shocked, you know, well, why aren't they documenting, you know, where we're at and let us sign in? Because there's, you know, no documentation of us even being there if we did come up missing. So, which I thought was kind of odd. But not really.
I'm sorry. This is Dr. John. I'm sorry for laughing. But it's like, well, there would be no documentation if we showed up missing. I'm sorry. That's kind of a fun statement, but it might be a true statement. Do you agree, Matt?
Yes, I do. That's why I said I was shocked, but I'm not, you know.
Well, we're glad. Well, listen, buddy, we're glad you're on the show tonight. And you're not documented as missing in action. All right, John May, what I'd like to do is for you to close our section on the land on the lakes, because Matt Dell, you're going to get a member of the Henderson family, hopefully, here week after next or whatever, and we are looking forward to having them. Fair enough?
Sounds great.
All right, so John LeMay, how would you like to encapsulate what we've talked about in your research? Because you've done a ton of research, and don't say you haven't. You're one of our best researchers in the world. You're on bat.
So listening to Robin and Matt both, you know, I kind of connected some dots in my head that I never had before. So, you know, Matt mentioned how President Kennedy, you know, is the one who made it into a state park. And state parks are just absolutely notorious for people going missing. And I think my mind started to wonder. I was like, you know what? Why is it state parks? You know, why isn't it anywhere that's not densely populated? And then I realized, well, more people are attracted to these state parks. More people go there. Therefore, more people disappear there. And because they are state parks, they maybe get a little bit more publicity as opposed to if I went exploring in the desert, you know, north of Roswell, which is not a state park, which nobody ever goes there. You know, if you go missing in one of those areas, people probably just don't know you're missing because they don't know where you went. Mm-hmm. But when you go into one of those state parks, you know, again, it's just more people go there. So it's maybe a little more shocking that so many people do disappear there. And I have to wonder, you know, Robin and Matt talked about maybe they were trying to control the population of the dogmen in the Land Between Lakes. And then on the other hand, I kind of wonder sometimes if the government's not in league with some of these things and they don't really mind that people are kind of being, I don't know, sacrificed, eaten by them, whatever. You know, because I think the deep state government is evil. And, you know, for all you know, maybe they're totally okay with it. Maybe they like it. So that's kind of where my mind wandered too, is just when Matt mentioned that it was a state park, because I forgot that it was a state park. And that's just kind of interesting, you know, because they're so notorious for those disappearances. And I believe what Robin says too, that, you know, they seek out the less densely populated areas because they want to be away from people. So it's just, that was my perspective and my take on the whole thing.
Wow. That's a great recap. It seriously is. And all I got to say is, Matt, thanks for your insight. Robin, thanks for your insight. Mark, again, thanks for your great questions. You know what? We really cover a lot here on ScaryCast. And as if we don't do enough, we're going to talk about another subject. Last week, we talked about the Bladenboro Monster. And I did a lot more research on it. There are some real contradictions on the things that were reported in the newspapers. One of this 3 feet long, it's 2 feet long, it's 5 feet long. It's like it's all different. And so John LeMay, I wanted to talk to you about that. And you had an interesting take on it that is just amazing.
Well, I just want to say it's funny how often my phone calls with John are so fortuitous. He'll call with something that I'm already kind of working on from a different perspective. So you know, I'd heard John talk about the Bladesboro. Was it Bladesboro? Is that right? Am I saying it right?
The Bladesboro Monster. Exactly.
Okay, yeah. So when he was talking about the Bladesboro Monster, you know, he mentioned it being a shapeshifter. But what got me is when he mentioned the time frame, which was the mid-1950s, because I was also working on a shape-shifting creature in the mid-1950s, way down deep south central Mexico. And these names are so hard to pronounce. And let's see, what is it? Tlaxcala. Tlaxcala, just for anybody who's listening, how you spell it is T-L-A-X-C-A-L-A, Tlaxcala. So that's like deep, deep central Mexico, very rural. And the Mexican government noticed that they were getting death certificates in the hundreds. And the cause of death would be marks, literally it would say sucked by the witch, like in other words, like a vampire. And there were always little infant babies who had died in the night, and they claimed that they had been drained of blood by these vampires. And this name is also really hard to pronounce. I don't think I've ever even heard it pronounced, but it's Tualapuchi. And I'll spell it before the show's over in case anybody wants to look it up. But best that I can tell, you pronounce it Tualapuchi, and they're almost always female. And, you know, they're not like the vampires that you see in the movies. They're so different. So according to their legends, they like to shapeshift into different animals, but they like to shapeshift into really small animals. And, you know, you have to think they have a big human body. You know, how would they transform into, you know, a tiny little bird or owl? And according to the mythos, what they do is they perform a ritual where they somehow sever their own legs and bottom torso, basically. So it's just their upper torso. And they do it over a fire, and they have their incantations and all that. And after they've done that, they're small enough that their upper body transforms into like a big owl or a turkey or just some sort of, you know, larger bird of prey, and they'll fly off. And, you know, it's like, you know, it's very folkloric. You know, supposedly they have to fly over the house first in the shape of a cross. That's their thing they've got to do before they enter. Then they'll kind of sneak in. And they always go for babies under a year old, anywhere between like 2 to 10 months old for some reason. That's just the, according to the folklore, that's the blood that they prefer. And sometimes they'll emit a paralyzing mist so the parents can't wake up, and they'll go and drain the infant of its life. And then the next morning, the parent will find it dead. And again, there were literally hundreds, though, death certificates in the mid-1950s. And the Mexican government definitely looked at those as folklore. They kind of looked at it as, well, they're being careless with their kids, so they're just blaming it on the witch because they're peasants, you know, was probably their mindset. So they instigated a law, or instituted a law, where if you wrote down the death certificate that it was, you know, sucked by the witch, you would be subject to a thorough investigation to make sure that you weren't just being careless with your baby. And I will say, even though, you know, I do believe in a lot of the cryptids we talk about on this show, it makes sense to me that they claim that the Tuilapuchi comes in the cold winter months or in the cold rainy months of the summer, because what other night would your baby freeze to death? What a really cold night or really damp, wet night when they didn't, you know, get covered up right, and they're, you know, frail, maybe a little malnourished. So I can definitely see in this case where there's a pretty good chance that, you know, maybe people were just blaming folklore on the fact that their baby froze to death in the night. And they weren't really very thorough in their investigation, because they never actually did an autopsy on any of these babies to see if they were, in fact, drained of blood. So they really couldn't prove it one way or the other. It would really be different if they had done several autopsies and just said, oh, well, they just froze to death in the night. Simple. You know, they didn't do that. So it is kind of, it's not really a case closed matter, but it just struck me, though, that there was a shapeshifter in Bladesboro, you know, that took on all sorts of different forms in exactly the same time period as these vampires from Tlaxcala. So I just thought that was really interesting. And I mean, they provoked a whole government investigation. It doesn't get any more X-Files than that, you know, than when the government actually gets involved. So, but after they instituted that law, the people kind of quit reporting it, probably just because they didn't want the government poking around. And the reports really basically died off by the early 70s. And after that, it was kind of just forgotten about.
Wow, that is an amazing recounting of what happened in Mexico. Now, Robin, I'm going to ask you, I hope you were listening. I know you were listening. You're the world's best. What do you think about that? Because we have the Bladesboro monster. We have something that sucks blood out of carcasses of animals. And we have the same thing going on. Something that's sucking blood out of carcasses of babies. Robin, what do you think? I mean, how do you reconcile this?
Well, I'm not going to say that it's very possible, you know, you're dealing with the same type of being. I mean, there's no way to say that you're not. The thing is, you get down by Mexico and some of these other areas, and you would be amazed all the stuff they've got there. I mean, really. You know, it's like they've got the, what do they call it? The, that sucks the blood.
Oh, chupacabra.
Thank you.
Chupacabra.
The chupacabra. My mind just went blank, guys. I'm sorry. The chupacabra.
Oh,
There's more than one kind.
And by the way, Robin, I've got to tell you, we've got three new fans of Scary Cast. They are saying great things about you and John LeMay. I love it when we get these new, and one especially is Jonathan Waltz.
Well, thank you. I'm glad
it's Jonathan Waltz from Mobile, and he's a good friend of mine. I'm so glad he's listening to us. All right, please go ahead. You're getting to this is what we want to hear.
The thing is, you've got two different kinds. You've got what they have down in Mexico, which is more of an ET-based chupacabra, okay? The reports that come out of Mexico, they're on two legs. They have more of a reptilian-type head, you know, very grotesque-looking, 6-7 foot tall, all these things. But then you go over to Texas. You get in Texas, and they're a canine that's hairless, and they have these nodules that hang off of the back of the back legs over by the rectum. So you have more than one type. So now you've got these other things that John has discovered is over in Mexico. Is it possible they're here? It's absolutely possible, because we already know that all these things have got a paranormal base to them. They all transfer through portals. So it's not impossible that they couldn't come here. The problem is there's just so many different kinds of beings that we don't even have names for. And we've talked about this on other shows. You know, there's just all this stuff that's out there. I mean, I think it definitely warrants a lot more investigation, because I don't think there's any just one thing that will suck the blood. Do I believe that there's a possibility it could be the same thing? Absolutely. But, again, we need more information to put it all together. But I think
I'd like to ask a question for Matt. Hey, Matt.
Yeah.
Is there any, geological kind of, like, fault line that goes through that area? I know there's one in the Appalachians. Is there any activity that correlates to that fault line goes as far as the mountain range or geological activity?
Oh, are you talking about for the line between the lakes?
Well, that... I'm just throwing it out there for that, or other things as well, like all-encompassing, because I know this is like the area you're from, right? And I know personally that UFO hotspots are always around this kind of plate tectonic geological locations for some reason. And I would just
wonder, or
other type. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yep. There is one that's north of me up into the Kentucky in the eastern part of Kentucky there that I know of, because we've had an earthquake one time, and I actually felt the house shake. I mean, it sounded like a train was going through. It was wild. First time I'd ever felt an earthquake. But it was more north of me. But like you're talking about, yeah, that whole area all up along that Appalachian, the mountains there and stuff. But you know what's hard? Like the ley lines, you can never get an accurate map of where these ley lines lay. Have you ever noticed that?
Is that where the mountains are?
Seems like they're always different. Yes.
Is there like any of those like big mountains that are along that line? So I know in the ley lines of that maybe Appalachian or like southern states, there's those like ancient mountains that go back thousands of years. That they're like
I've got lots of Indian mountains close to my house. Actually, one just a couple miles down the road from me. They're all along the mountains there. And then you got it all the way up into the Cherokee, and yeah, it's the whole area is just Native American mounds, and they're not burial mounds. I mean, they're just mounds that got artifacts from the one close to my house is from the 1400s. So,
well, they go way back.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, as far as the mountain area up there, anyhow, it's high energy. I think a lot of it's got to do with the different minerals and stuff as well.
You know, you guys are talking about some very interesting things, especially about the ley line. There's only so much that I can discuss about this, but I know where there are ley lines near Clayton, Georgia, and that's what led me to run the Georgia Bigfoot Conference there. And we'll all discuss this in private, and we'll we'll decide what is appropriate to tell. But yeah, ley lines are important. Robin, you started talking. Please talk.
I'm sorry.
No,
I agree with the ley line theory. I really do. I just have one question. I don't have ley lines. Why do I still have them? I mean, I think the ley lines have a lot of importance, and I think they, because I think the ley lines carry more energy, so I think things are drawn to it. But I don't even have to be by ley lines. I mean, it's just like, it's a walking freak show at any time, day or night.
I've got the answer to that. You are higher consciousness. You are higher consciousness level. And therefore, you're attracted. You walk around with like a light bulb above your head to these things.
I know. I mean, and it had to have been that way since I popped out, because it was going on by the time I was 3 and 4 years old. I mean, I can remember my earliest memory. I wasn't even 3 yet because I still wasn't talking really well and I was still getting mind speak. But it's just unbelievable. It doesn't stop. You know, I mean, now I'm getting flashbacks to when I got abducted 2.5 weeks ago. And it's like, for the love of God, just leave me alone for 5 minutes, you know.
How often do ley lines correlate with, like, other, like, you know, seismic activity? And you got to wonder about, like, planetary vortexes in these areas or areas of, like, the cradles of civilization and things where, like, certain energies flowed into at certain points. I think that that is also going to be where you're going to experience more cryptid activity, more UFO activity, more interdimensional things as well, but not – doesn't have to be like we're on the planet, we can experience it anywhere, but there's going to be the higher concentration spots at certain areas
with a low magnetic field as well,
because
that's where, because your whole portal theory, you know, it's got to have a zero magnetic field with a high burst of energy, a high energy area.
If you create the Earth into a tetrahedron where, like, the tropics are and things like that, the geometries of just the kind of rotation of the planets and that in itself, I think on the, like, outer stratospheric scale, you'll have these, like, potential portals that will be natural, interdimensional, because you're dealing with high energy in an atmospheric setting and gravity coming in from the sun, like solar flares even hitting the Earth. Things like that, you're going to have, like, these vortices where you're going to have interdimensional activity, I guarantee.
Yeah, it's like whenever you have a lot of solar flare activity going on, you'll hear of a lot more encounters of stuff. So
that's when I saw my UFOs, you know. When it was during this, I saw the Northern Lights. I've told this on this podcast before. The first time I saw a huge UFO fleet was during the Northern Lights. So that solar flare interaction, I believe that's my own theory.
Wow, that's cool. All right. So, and Robin, thanks for that. John May, what do you think about all this? This is kind of an interesting discussion.
You know, I've forgotten about that those even existed before y'all mentioned it tonight. I'd forgotten all about this. I'm glad you brought them up.
But I did make a promise to listeners, because I know there's somebody out there who probably wants to Google this Tualapuche, and I mean, you don't know how to spell it based on how I said it. So anybody who wanted to Google this thing, get your pen and paper real quick. Here's how you spell it. TLAHUELPUCHI. Tualapuche. So, I mean, it's quite a mouthful.
That is so cool. And thank you. And you know what? I guess what you've done, John, is you have really brought us to a new level of things. I mean, we talk about things here on ScaryCast that are completely different than Coast to Coast AM or whatever. We talk about the real thing. So anyway, we're all going to, you know, work together. Sooner or later, you know, I'll talk to everybody, and we'll have another roundtable discussion next time here. And by the way, Dr. Trip Donnelly, tonight, of course, he is one of our favorites. But he wanted to talk about, and I wanted to put this in your ear so so that we can talk about it next time you're on. It's like, why now? Why are we having this disclosure about UFOs now? Is it something that they said you better do it now, or you better do it now, or we're going to do it for you, or whatever? And
they don't have a choice. They don't have a choice at this point. And they're not disclosing it. Be clear on this. They are disclosing crap. They're telling us information that we've already known. They're giving us just enough to shut everybody up so they can continue doing what they're doing and hiding what they're hiding. They're backed into a corner. Something has to be said.
Well, Robin, thank you very much for answering the question.
That's my opinion.
Let it know tomorrow. It's just good. I'm sorry. Please. Say that again one more time, and I'll know exactly what's in. Do you mind?
Sorry, did you ask me a question? You were breaking up there.
No.
Yeah, you're breaking up.
We'll go farther to the parking lot. So, Rob,
I can't understand you, sweetie.
If you can please repeat what you said.
What I said was, in my own opinion, is they really don't have a choice. They have to say something. They have put this off for decades and kept their mouth shut, haven't said a thing. Meanwhile, the whole world is watching this unfold. Whether they've said anything or not, it's unfolding anyway. It's happening. Everybody's becoming more aware of it. They have to say something. In order to get the pressure off of them, they've got to give some kind of what they're calling disclosure. It's not a disclosure. Be realistic about it, because they're not really telling us anything. Every time they say there's going to be a big disclosure, they go on and do it. They haven't told us anything that anybody doesn't already know.
The only disclosure is the one that we figure out for ourselves. The only disclosure is the ones you look, open your eyes and look for yourself. You know what I mean? Don't let anybody tell you what it's real or not in the universe. Look for yourself.
Well,
grow
not
up.
Only that.
When it comes, that's what humanity is to grow up.
Yeah. But right now they're in a position where everybody's pushing. We want a disclosure. We want you to make a statement. We want you to tell us this. They don't want to tell us anything. So all they're doing is taking the information we've already put out there and recycling it, giving it back to us. Any of the important stuff is still not being disclosed. We have the label of a disclosure, but we don't have any disclosure. And anybody that does try to do a disclosure gets threatened. You know, I mean,
yep.
It's really, honestly, in my own opinion, it's a big waste of time.
There's a bunch of counterculture false information out there. Every time there's a counterculture, it's always controlled by the CIA and black operations. And like back in the day, you had the Black Panthers. That was like FBI, CIA operation. Of the counterculture, the same as with the UFO one. I guarantee that there's a bunch of misdirect information that's being classified as a, quote, disclosure, but it's really not. It's misdirecting us away from the reality of the situation, which we can see ourselves if we just do some discernment and open our eyes and look at reality for what it is and understand and just see things for what it is.
Is we now have government officials coming forward as quote-unquote whistleblowers, okay? The honest-to-God truth is, if they were really whistleblowers that were not allowed to give us this information, the government would have already killed them.
Yeah,
I know researchers in this field of research that are dead now because it was a government hit, which nobody, of course, can prove, because they knew too much. These whistleblowers, in my opinion, are nothing more than people that the government is using as a front to be called the whistleblower, and they're leaking information that the government is perfectly aware they're leaking because they're being told to leak it.
It's called the status quo. They're creating the status quo of the UFO culture. So essentially that's what it is. It's called social engineering of a counterculture, which that's what we're a part of. That's what even a part of the show, you know, like, we're looking at things as ufology and Bigfoot and cryptids and things, but a lot of the information we're being given has been potential engineered and misconstrued to direct us away from the truth. And I believe in my UFO
things that I've come across.
I
don't take I don't get information from the public. I don't get information from all these things. The information that I believe in, the information that I know, is because I've been taught by the cryptids. I don't trust any of the stuff that comes out in the government as this is being fact, because they tell you what they want you to know, just like they tell people they can't speak telepathically. That's a damn lie. We've been programmed to believe it doesn't exist and that we can't do it. There isn't anybody that can't do it. Everybody gets to it in their own time, yes. Most people are doing it already and have no clue they're doing it. They don't know what the signs are. They don't know what it all entails. They just assume they're not doing it because they're not hearing words beaming in their head. And it's the same thing with the disclosures. We're being told these are disclosures like they're giving us this great prize. They're not telling us anything we didn't already know. And what little bit they are telling us that we didn't know doesn't matter.
It's because it's a psyop. It's a psychological operation to control the minds and culture on the counter of the counterculture operation, which cryptids, Bigfoot, all of it's a big part of. You know, you watch the shows with Bigfoot, it's fucking a joke, right? Compared to what we actually know. Yeah, no, they're like, they're just like hitting a tree in the woods, like trying to communicate with them. No, man, like, they are, it's a reality, but like, and UFOs are reality, but the way these shows on, like, I don't know, whatever networks you watch on them, I think even, I don't know, I want to say William Shatner's show, but like people that he's been a part of, like the sci-fi community and Michael Kakao or whatever his name is, I think they really like try to bring down the true reality for the general public, the general populace and the status quo. They're not going to disclose to the status quo the real situation, guaranteed. Never. You got to look for yourself.
I don't watch any of the Bigfoot shows. I never have. I mean, I'm filming with some people that are doing a documentary right now. I'm not probably going to watch that either. I mean, and it's not that I don't think there's good information in it, and a lot of the people that are in the documentaries I know. But I also know that everything is so censored by the government, you're so pigeonholed from getting the truth out. You know, there's only going to allow so much truth out there. And I don't know it all. I'm not an expert, but I do know what I've experienced, and I know what they've taught me. You know, and so it's like, it's just crazy. It is. And it's the same situation when it comes to the aliens and the ETs and the UFOs and all of it. What little bit of information that is something that we may not know is not important enough. Okay? We need to know the whys. We need to know the hows. We need to know how many different races that are out there and what are, you know, what does each one represent? What does each one want from our people? Why are they working with our government? Why are they helping the government create cryptids? You know, there's a lot of whys out there, and there's absolutely no answers to it. And even when I come on, like, these podcasts and talk about it, trust me, I get government pushback afterwards. I don't walk away scot-free. You know, they know what they're doing. They don't play games. And it's just, it's really sad, but we're never going to get the information that we need to know. The other hand of it, I completely understand they don't want to create mass panic. But the best way to not create mass panic is quit lying to us.
Well, you know what, Robin, I got to say this. At least they continue to let ScaryCast produce episodes, and we're glad that they do. Do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I mean, you really do. So I tell you what, we are running up against our time. First of all, thanks, voiceofnorthgeorgia.com, for having us on here. And if we're all okay with it, I want to give John LeMay the last word, because he is a great author. He's brought so many things to this table tonight. So, John LeMay, what do you have to say to close this episode?
I think this is one of the best shows we've ever done, because it jumped so many different topics. You know, we went from werewolves to vampires to aliens. You know, so, I mean, if you weren't interested in one, you're guaranteed to be interested in one of them. So I love the diversity of topics we had tonight. I loved having Matt on so he could do a lot of the talking and I could rest. So, I mean, anytime Matt wants to be on same time as me, I'm down for it. And I really enjoyed listening to him. It's the first time I've ever heard him talk, and it was fascinating. So I really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you.
Well, I tell you what, we enjoyed having you on here. You are absolutely one of our favorite guests. And will you be back the first Monday of next month?
Always. Were we asking me or Matt?
I'm asking you, will you be on there the next?
Oh, yeah, always. Yeah, I think it'll be the UFO Festival by then, actually, so that'll be interesting.
All right, well, that'll be good. We've got a lot to talk about. Thank you. Been on StrayCast tonight. This has been about as much fun as I've ever had. We've had great discussions, and we will be back next week with Nick Burnett. He's a sci-fi and horror producer for Netflix. So we're looking forward to having him, and we're going to have a great time. So we'll see you next time on the only ScaryCast. Here.
Good night, everybody.
Take
good night.
Care.
Good night, everyone.
Bye.
Right.
Bye-bye.